across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlow.
Thank you, Don Rue. Welcome to the second hour of Up North News Radio for this Monday, June 26th, National Chocolate Pudding Day. We already talked about it being National Barcode Day, National Beauticians Day. It's a really nice day up here up north. We're at 61 degrees, a bit of a chilly north wind, but after so much heat last week, it's nice to have a little rain and a little relief. If you missed our last hour where we talked about all the zeros that Republicans put in the state budget, you can catch the show anytime by subscribing to it as a podcast. Go to Apple, Spotify, any of the usual places, as well as the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us. And you can reach us live here in the studio at 844-967-2789 and email us at radio@upnorthnewswi.com. I'm joined now by two long experienced educators across Wisconsin. Jim Shaw is acting superintendent from South Milwaukee. He has spent his life in education as an educator and administrator, been part of the Wisconsin Association of Excellent Schools, Wisconsin Public Education Network. Jim Bowman is a former educator and school board member in the Appleton area. He heads up Fox City's Advocates for Public Education. They are a very active advocacy group for public schools. And so Jim Shaw and Jim Bowman could not be better choices to talk about the state budget and the grand compromise that was reached between Governor Evers and legislative Republicans, and whether that's the best that we could expect from this state budget, which could pass sometime this week. Jim Shaw, Jim Bowman, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Good morning, Pat.
Thanks for having us, Pat.
Nice to have both of you here. Let's see. We've got, I guess I have to start with the term compromise, because there's been a lot of discussion about whether the compromise that increased public school funding, but also greatly increased funding for vouchers for private and religious schools, if that was really the best deal that we could get from this legislature and this governor. Now, the components of that a compromise did pass last week separate from the budget. So what is it that you are telling people in the Capitol and around Wisconsin this week that you think could yet be changed before the budget bill passes? Jim Bowman, you want to give that a go first?
I talked to people about the impact of the proposed budget on our schools. So I think it's heads are swimming with these huge numbers, but people can understand the need to hold on to our good teachers, to be able to give them a salary increase that is at least comes as close as we can to at least keeping them whole with the high levels of inflation that they are experiencing. And that's the number one concern of most superintendents, is that the budget won't enable them to hold on to their talented staff.
And Jim Shaw, is that the main concern that you talk about as far as whether something could be changed in the state budget this week?
I think so. And our school board in South Milwaukee just passed a resolution because they referred to this budget as inadequate, inequitable, and hurtful. So that's pretty strong language. And I think they felt that way for a number of reasons. Maybe one of the most important reasons is the funding for special education. You know, special education kids are our most vulnerable kids. Those are the kids we take pride in serving in public schools, because we're the schools for all the kids of all the people. We want to serve our special education kids. The state right now is funding special education at about 33% with the increase. That still makes Wisconsin one of the worst states in the nation and funding for special education. Again, our most vulnerable kids, the kids we take pride in public schools and in serving. So this budget, to me, I agree with our school board, I think it's hurtful. We need the resources for our special education kids.
I do this every time, and I'm going to do it again this time, because it was a surprise the first time I heard it last year, and I think more people need to hear about the abysmal rate of reimbursement, because special education costs a lot more, and there was once a time where the state reimbursed school districts 90% of the cost of special education, but as that number's gone lower and lower, school districts still have to spend that money, but then because they're not being reimbursed by the state, that money is coming out of their, you know, general spending that would otherwise be used throughout the schools. And Jim Bowman, I'm not expecting you to know the history of it, but for it to come, however low it went, I think well below 30%, that 33% is that really a compromise in your estimation?
No, it is not. And it's very inadequate. And the public needs to understand that special ed kids are being paid. In other words, we are getting the services to special ed kids that the law requires and that we think we need. The loss due to the low reimbursement is everybody else. It's all the kids who do not have an IEP, who do not have a disability. And that's about 85% of the Wisconsin public, so public school body. So all these kids who do not have a disability are losing out. They're not getting the services that they deserve, particularly in smaller class sizes.
We are talking to Jim Bowman of the Fox Cities Advocates for Public Education, and Jim Shaw is the interim superintendent in South Milwaukee. And we're going to continue this conversation in just a bit on what can be done in the state budget bill yet before it passes the legislature, perhaps this week, that can take last week's school funding compromise and amend it so that we do less damage to public education in Wisconsin, something that has been sadly a trend for the past 12 years or so. We'll be back with more. First, we'll check the weatherology forecast and a quick check on sports next. You're up north. All right, the Milwaukee Brewers managed to take 2 of 3 from Cleveland. It wasn't always pretty, but they did so. And in winning yesterday, that just keeps them just a bit under the Cincinnati Reds, who are coming off that, I think it was a 12-game winning streak before they hit a couple of losses this week. Owen Miller had the tie-breaking double in the 10th inning as the Brewers beat Cleveland 5-4 on Sunday. They're now in New York for a 4-game series against the Mets. 6 o'clock start time each evening this week, and then it's off to Pittsburgh next weekend as the road trip rolls on. All right, I mentioned it's a lot cloudier out here, a little cooler with that north wind and everything else that we deal with here, but summer in Wisconsin will do that. It'll throw you a heat wave one day and a little bit of a chill the next, although it's, I would argue, somewhat refreshing. Here's Michael Caro. He's got the state of Wisconsin forecast, all border to border, coast to coast for the state from Weatherology. Michael, good morning.
Good morning to you. And yeah, we are looking to stay cooler than average here across all the state here to start off your work week for today. Only expecting highs in the upper 60s to lower 70 degree range in areas like the Fox River Valley over to near Green Bay and down to near Milwaukee, where we'll also have the better chance for some measurable rain lingering there, especially in areas closest to the Lake Michigan shoreline for today. But much of the remainder of the state, you can't completely rule out some isolated showers or sprinkles out there for today, as that slow moving area of low pressure continues to remain nearly stationary across the eastern Great Lakes. High temperatures and to the western portions of Wisconsin for today, closer to the middle to upper range of the 70s. Then for tonight, any lingering showers wrapping up across eastern portions of Wisconsin early on this evening will stay dry across much of the remainder of the state for tonight. Overnight low temperatures dropping back into the lower 50s for Wausau, the middle 50s for Eau Claire over to near Amory, and upper 50s for areas like Madison and down to near Milwaukee. As high pressure then builds in from the west on Tuesday, more in the way of sunshine making a return, and we're back closer to average temperature-wise, could approach some middle 80-degree readings for areas like Eau Claire down to near La Crosse. I think we'll stick closer, though, to the 70s, upper 70s for Oshkosh over to near Sheboygan as well there for your Tuesday, with more in the way of sunshine again statewide for tomorrow. Another trough of low pressure, though, works in from the west on Wednesday, bringing our next chance for some scattered showers and storms there. Still no major heat waves midweek, looking at lower to middle 80-degree readings for southern and western portions of Wisconsin, upper 70s and lower 80s expected across the east, and then some hit-and-miss type shower and storm chances both Thursday and into your Friday, but not expecting any washouts any one day. Middle to upper 80s, a possibility into the far southwestern corner of the state on Thursday, but I think much of the remainder of the state in the upper 70s to lower 80s.
All sounding very good, Michael. Thank you very much. Have a great week.
You too.
That's Michael Cairo from Weatherology joining us every morning, along with Jennifer Wojcicki to keep us updated on things. Right now, it's 66 in La Crosse. It's 59 for folks in Wisconsin Rapids listening on locally grown radio. The folks listening to us on Oshkosh Air Support, 66 degrees out by you. And in Amory, folks listening to Lake Air, 63 degrees. And here on Lake Wissota, it is 64 for folks listening on our home base, 93.5 The Tap. Let's continue our conversation now with Jim Bowman and Jim Shaw. We are talking about the school funding in Wisconsin. There was a compromise bill that was passed last week. It does increase funding, but that, as I've said before, let's not give this Republican-controlled legislature a lot of credit. They're quote-unquote making better a problem that they've created year after year after year. And so, gentlemen, as you're asking the people around you to contact their state legislators, it really starts, I would argue, Jim Shaw, first and foremost, with just improve the overall funding for public schools. Yeah, this compromise was one thing, but Jim, I'm sure you think they could do better.
Well, we're 14 years behind inflation. So for 14 years, we have not funded the schools at inflationary levels required by inflation. And that is compounded at the same time that the needs of our kids have never been greater. We're just seeing, even last week, recent test scores came out. Kids' test scores have dropped. And that is compounded by some of the social mental health issues that the kids experienced during the COVID pandemic. So our children need help in getting back on track. And at the same time that the needs have never been greater, we have funding that is 14 years behind inflation, that is not funding special education at the level. It's a state mandated program, yet we're funding it at 30% of the cost. And then most recently in South Milwaukee, we're a high poverty district. The state legislature decided to eliminate high poverty aid. So we lost $150,000 last week in funding for the South Milwaukee schools because we have poor children. That's inequitable, it's inadequate, and it's hurtful, as our school board has said in their resolution.
Jim Bowman, let's talk a bit more about the mental health aspect of it. Governor Evers did propose a very large increase in funding for resources. Republicans turned that into zero in the Joint Finance Committee. I honestly don't know what, if anything, they restored back in terms of an increase in mental health services. But whatever it is, Jim Bowman, tell me more about the crisis of mental health and how much more is going to be needed for kids. Something that, by the way, predated the pandemic, right?
Yeah, one significant cause of mental health issues in the K through 12 schools is in families with lower income levels. Now, in my district, that's Appleton, about 40% of our kids are classified as low income. And that's about representative of the whole state. Now, if you think about those families, they are generally on low income, working low income minimum wage jobs. And when that job folds, when the job ends, when they get laid off, they get laid off. Now they can probably find another minimum wage job in the current income, but it's in current economy, but it's probably at a different organization. And they may have to move from one location, one rental unit to another. So the effect on children in the K through 12 schools is that we've got kids who slept in cars the night before. So they're in class trying to learn about Chaucer when they know they didn't get a good night's sleep when the other kids did. We've got other kids that are moved from school to school because their parents are relocated from one rental unit to another. And so they are uprooted with a whole new class of peers and that are strange. And those two problems, where you slept the night before and the peers you have, cause mental health issues, particularly in the elementary ages. So we need specialists at the schools that will help the kids and the parents deal with these issues. And for that, we need funding.
Not to mention as well, these kids are also often going hungry. And again, the governor proposed no-cost school lunches and breakfast, and Republicans took that out as well. Jim Shaw, let me start with you, interim superintendent in South Milwaukee. And look, folks are going to say, well, you're talking to public school advocates and, you know, you're just going to sit here and bash private schools. And to me, it's not about bashing private schools, although it can be argued that they're less accountable and no more successful than public schools. But the point isn't the school's existence. The point is the vouchers. And Jim Shaw, it seems to me that after all these years, what started as a tiny voucher experiment really does have the Wisconsin taxpayer paying for two school systems, two parallel school systems in the state. I can't imagine there's any other state like that. And I also can't imagine that is sustainable for South Milwaukee and every other public school district.
Well, I don't think two public school systems are sustainable. We have one public school system that is accountable, and we have another private school, publicly funded system, that will be unaccountable. And I don't think that is, first of all, sustainable. But secondly, I think it's going to lead to some inequality. I think when we talk about, are all schools going to be representative of their populations? Are we going to have equal poverty rates, equal people represented by creed, by race, by religion, by poverty? So we want to have all the kids of all the people served in our public schools. And we are going to create one system that is not going to serve all the kids. It's going to have the ability to select, to choose, to screen basically who comes to their schools, and then to be unaccountable for the results. So no, I do not think that two school systems are sustainable in the long run. And will be unfair and inequitable.
So Jim Bowman, this week, again, folks are gathering in the Capitol, what I call a lobbyist with a lowercase L, you know, regular folks who are just trying to, through other groups, trying to make their case to amend the state budget, if you will. Jim, it's not like you can have people call in and say, just put back everything Governor Evers proposed. But if somebody were to call the Wisconsin Legislative Hotline at 800-362-9472 and be connected with the offices of their state assembly rep or state senator, what exactly would you like the average person just to say to the office of their assembly rep or senator? What is the ask they should be making?
I would like for them to talk about real life in the public schools in their area. I'd like for them to talk about the school down the street. My advocacy group, we talk to superintendents to ask them what the impact of this budget compromise will be. And we are hearing some of our major districts in the Fox Cities have only enough funding in that budget to fund their schools for 1 year. The two-year budget gives them enough money for 1 year. For the second year, they're going to have to find money someplace else. One district's going to go to fund balance, which is savings. You can only do that once or twice. You just can't keep robbing your savings to pay for operations. So I'd like for the common public residents to get a better feel for how this budget affects their child or the child down the street, and then talk to their representative about real life.
And then last question for both of you, and this gets away from the text of a bill or the numbers in a bill. And just your own, I just want to close with your own feelings on this. I'm going to say it as if you needed reminding. We have a budget surplus of $7 billion. Jim Bowman, what do you make of having that large of a surplus, and yet you're here in the last week of the budget bill scrimping and asking people for change to help these school districts? How does that feel?
The felt need of legislators to award tax reductions is now in competition with the school down the street. There's so much money to go along, and they are pulled in different directions. One direction is to invest in the children of the future, and the other is to reduce tax rates. And the current legislature is giving more preference to reducing taxes.
And Jim Shaw, what's your feeling on the opportunities that may have been lost with this surplus?
I've been a superintendent in urban districts and suburban districts, in rural districts. They have one thing in common. They're the heart of the community. People value their public schools. They want public schools to be funded. And That's a Wisconsin value. That's part of the Wisconsin idea. We value public education. This budget devalues public education. There is no reason right now that this surplus money, at least some of it, could be devoted to the thing that most people value most in their community, their children and their local public schools.
Jim Shaw, Jim Bowman, thank you both very much. Wish you all the best this week with your efforts.
We'll
be back to talk about child care counts. You're up north.
Follow Up North News with our daily newsletter. Go to our website, upnorthnewswi.com, and click newsletter on the top banner. Once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
We are going to talk again about the effort to save affordable child care in Wisconsin. It is not a Wisconsin-only problem, so let's take a look from a national standpoint to tell you that billions of dollars in federal subsidies for child care providers are going to run out in September, and Democrats in Congress have been sounding the alarm about a child care cliff. There was some $40 billion from the American Rescue Plan that relieved the burden on the economy during the pandemic, and that allowed child care facilities to raise wages, to lower tuition, to expand services. But with that program ending September 30th, an estimated 3.2 million children could lose access to child care. And the Century Foundation estimates that one-third of the child care facilities that receive the funding will close. That's going to cost the American economy an estimated $10 billion a year and cost families $9 billion annually in lost earnings. Now, it's going to hit every state. But now let's bring the focus back to Wisconsin and what it's going to do here, because the state, stop me if you've heard this before, has a $7 billion surplus. Governor Evers proposed saying, okay, that federal money is going to go away. We have a surplus. Let's put $340 million towards it. Republicans did not opt to put a smaller number in there. Well, they did. The number was zero. And ever since then, people like Corrine Hendrickson and Joan Beck have been trying to advocate members of the legislature to put it back in. They're going to continue that work this week in hopes of getting the budget bill amended before the budget bill goes to Governor Evers for a signature or veto. Joan and Corrine, good morning. Thank you for being here.
Morning.
Corrine, you have been especially active on this. We've talked about your testimony before Congress on the matter. You are already well familiar with what's happening at a national standpoint. And it sure seems that when you explain it this way, with a state surplus, that this shouldn't be this hard. But Corrine, you know you have your work cut out for you this week.
Yeah, absolutely. It's mind-boggling how hard it is, because the very same people who talk about common sense investments and making sure that, you know, our communities have what they need and talk about how important families and children are, the very same people who are basically zeroing out every single support for families and children. And they're doing tax cuts for the richest and trying to claim that, you know, because there are more people who are going to be receiving the tax cuts, it's a bigger tax cut for that group of people. But that's not how math works. So yeah, we're working really hard to inform people of how this will actually impact them. So much we hear it's a parent's problem, but then forgetting the fact that if parents can't work, then they aren't going to get goods and services that they want. And those restaurants that are always closed, that they're complaining about shorter hours, you know, that's all going to be impacted, because really at the end of the day, if there's no care for children, mostly women, some men, but mostly women will be forced out of the workforce.
Joan, can you talk about it from the standpoint of your child care center in Dodge County, what the child care counts program has meant during the years of the pandemic? And again, I hasten to add, this was a problem before the pandemic. It simply made it worse. But what have the past couple of years been like with assistance?
The past couple of years, we've finally been able to pay wages to our staff that they should be paid. Most of my staff have associate or bachelor's degree, and if they go out into the real world, they're making a lot more than $13, $14, $15 an hour. With the child care counts funding, I was able to give bonuses, raise their wages, and not only child care has raised wages, but everyone across the state has raised wages. So for me now to come back to my staff and say, hey, I'm going to have to cut your bonuses, I'm going to have to cut your wages, I will have no workforce left. And that is the biggest problem that I see. Plus, we will raise rates. So families that are already strapped paying fees are now going to be charged even more, which is going to make my program and all the programs across the state just for the upper middle class who can afford us. It's really cutting out the strong middle class workforce. The common man who goes to work every day cannot afford childcare in the state of Wisconsin. And that is just going to continue more and more. And that's the biggest problem I see is to maintain my workforce. Like Corrine said, everybody is trying to maintain a workforce. I have to raise rates. I don't know what the families are going to do, how they're going to afford to pay that. Plus, I have a wait list of parents who are waiting to get into my program so I can tap into them, but I'm not sure if they can afford me either. And when Congress was saying that childcare families have a lot of choices, they didn't take into effect that every program across the state has a wait list with 50 to 80 to 90 children on that wait list because parents cannot find childcare, especially parents of infants. Infant care just does not exist in Wisconsin the way it should. And that is very sad for our economy, for our workforce, for Wisconsin going forward. If we don't care for the youngest people in our state, who's going to be around? It's going to end there.
So let me get into some of the more political or economic arguments about this. And I heard, Corrine, when you were on with Kristen Bry a few days back, I know Gary from Sussex called in with this question, and it's come up in other places as well, is what is so special about childcare? Are we picking winners and losers because there were a lot of sectors of the economy that benefited from federal pandemic relief? Why this one? And look, I could talk for the next 20 minutes and answer that question, but I'd like to hear it from somebody who's actually in the trenches. Talk about the importance of this particular pandemic relief program continuing on. Is this picking winners and losers?
Absolutely not, because before the pandemic happened, we were fighting and advocating and talking about how childcare is the foundation of our economies. Childcare is the workforce behind the workforce today and tomorrow. We build those brains. Back to 90% of the brain is developed by the age of five. If you have caring, responsive relationships with an adult, parent, teacher, neighbor, whatever, your brain will be built to its biggest capacity. And then in the future, you will then also be able to be a productive member of our society and be thriving. We are one of the only countries in the world that does not invest in our children. We do about $500 per infant toddler. That's our average. The rest of the developed world does approximately 11,000 up to 20 some thousand plus in the Nordic countries. They invest because they use the actual studies that we did in the 60s and 70s to create the actual programs and implement them that we then tried to do in 1972 when we passed universal childcare. So this isn't a new thing, but the pandemic was our opportunity as advocates to be able to say, hey, now is your chance to invest in us. Now is your chance to really understand what is happening and how we can benefit from it and what it will do if you put money into childcare. So that's the biggest thing. Right now, our parents are paying out of pocket, but so are the ones who care for and educate the children by not charging what we need to charge. So we charge a market rate like any other business. You know what you can charge for your product. Our product is people, though. So we can't really go back and say, okay, now you're a doctor. You owe me for the years of work I did with you. Same with the K-12 system. It's the same idea. It's a public good. So for instance, when people say that parents should be paying the true cost of care, that means that it should be around $21,600 for an infant to two-year-old and $10,800 for six-year-olds. Right now in Greene County, where I live, our average rate per month is around $1,000 max for those 0 to 2 year olds. So those parents are supposed to come up with another $800 a month. Are you kidding me? And how are their employers going to react once they find that out, that they have to now double the wages for every single employee so that their working parents can stay working for them?
So again, coming back from a political standpoint, this, I want to do a follow-up with you, Corrine, and then I'm going to go to Joan, because we're going to talk about the two co-chairs of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. Again, the Joint Finance Committee is what, writes the budget. There's not a Senate Finance Committee and an Assembly Finance Committee. They have a joint committee. They do it together. And the co-chairs, Republicans, of course, are Mark Bourne, State Assembly Rep, and Howard Markline. And Corrine, I do recall you saying last week that every effort that's been made to try to convey the seriousness of this issue to Senator Markline hasn't just fallen on deaf ears, but an outright refusal to meet with childcare providers, please tell me something has changed since then.
Well, no, they haven't reached out to meet with us. However, after we did the rally last week, we sent people in that were attending up to the offices of their representatives and said, hey, knock on the door, politely talk to them about child care counts and ask them to support the amendment for $340 million to the state budget to continue the program. So several of us went up to Senator Markline's office. He was in Joint Finance Committee meetings, and we spent about an hour in there talking with his people and telling them, you know, this is what this really means. This $95 million sheet handout that you have prepared for us as we walk in the door really isn't, you know, truthful. Brooke Skidmore went with me and she said, well, this right here isn't state money. Yes, you allocated it, but it's federally required money that comes from the federal government for those specific programs that they're highlighting. That's not state money. It's just federal money that we're using to support our childcare. And our state so far has a $0 investment in the state budget for it.
Wait, that's exactly what they're doing with broadband, where they said, well, yes, there's federal money coming in, and so therefore we can bring the state share down to zero, and they call it good when, I mean, that's impressive. Joan, you're in Assembly Rep Mark Bourne's district, the other co-chair. What's the communication been like with Representative Bourne?
It's very good. Representative and Bourne and I developed a relationship early on when he was a newbie in Congress. And And he's reached out to me a number of times. And he says the biggest problem is he can't get the Republican Party to move on this. He said it's like a brick wall. And mainly it's because so many different people were funded with the COVID funds, and they all want to continue that funding. And I get that. I get that. Once you get the slush of money, you want it to keep coming. But I keep impressing on him that if you don't fund childcare, and I just talked to him recently, and I said, the fallout from this is going to be dramatic across the state. If we think there are restaurants and businesses having trouble now finding care, just wait, give it another 4, 5, 6 months, year. It'll be dramatic how many fewer people are at work in the state because they can't get childcare. And the other thing I always say to him is, like Corrine pointed out, when you invest in the youngest people in our society, you invest in long-term returns. It's proven that if a child gets good quality care early on, they're more likely to graduate from high school. They're more or less likely to be incarcerated. So many positive things that are part of it that save us money down the road. It's a long-term investment, and it's been proven by many studies that $1 invested in childcare returns anywhere from $15 to $17 at the end result. And I think that's to me is the dramatic point right there.
Oh, without a doubt. And for those legislators, and you know, for any who just might happen to be listening, to say, well, we can't help everybody. That's your job, is not to fund everybody, but to make decisions. Now, decisions were made. Every budget is about making decisions. So don't just say, well, everybody's got their hand out. Everybody's asking for money. So what? That's your job, is to look at all of those and say, here's where we want to put our priority. And at the moment, Corrine, it seems like they're choosing tax cuts for millionaires as being a more important use of the surplus than early childhood education.
Yeah, and it doesn't make sense to me because, again, if you want to say that you can't help everyone, honestly, the best way to help everyone is to invest in childcare. It helps the parents, it helps the families, it helps the educators, it helps the K-12 system because we have those kids better prepared to go to school. We've identified special education needs, and we are getting them the services that they need at 3 and 4 instead of waiting till they get to the school at 5 and 6. Like they talk about criminal rates. We expel children from childcare for behavior problems at 3 times the rate of the entire K-12 system. And then those kids are 8 times more likely to end up in jail. So if you want to talk crime rates, you want to talk healthcare, those first 5 years, like nutrition and everything like that, it will decrease our healthcare costs later. So really, if you want to invest in our entire state, the number one thing you can do is put it in childcare.
And I would say for folks, again, we talked about this in the last segment as well, but the legislative hotline number is 800-362-9472, and let them know about the importance. Again, it doesn't have to be all $340 million. It arguably should be more, but zero is just not an acceptable number for this. Joan Beck, Corrine Hendrickson, again, we appreciate the update. We know you have a very busy week ahead, but thanks for making time and telling our listeners more about what's at stake this week.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Have a very good day. Well, when we come back, we'll talk just a bit more about this topic, and then we'll move into three things that you should know to start the week with Civic Media News Director Terry Bell. That's all just ahead. You're up north. Director with three things to know to get the week started. But just to tie a bow on this child care topic and what it means for other matters in the budget. In terms of, Corrine mentioned this earlier, but if only you could see this bar graph of how much government spends on child care for toddlers. And way up at the top is Norway. And the bar goes all the way across the screen at $29,000. Spent on child care for toddlers. That's the value they put on toddlers. Iceland, Finland, Denmark, Germany at $18,000. New Zealand at $10,000. The bars get smaller and smaller until you get to, you know, Lithuania at $8,000 and Hungary at $7,000. And then Israel at $3,000. And then barely a blip, barely a bar, the United States at $500. $500 is the value. But again, as we found through pandemic relief and state budgets, there are things that you can do about it. Bill Okonomowoc is on the line talking just a bit about the budget decisions that we make. Bill, good morning.
I got to get back to get on the radio. All right, they're going to church.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Bill. Go ahead.
Good morning. You know, the problem we have in our state is we have politicians that want to invest in millionaires and other politicians that want to invest in Wisconsin. And it boils down to this. 12 years ago, that shared revenue was destroyed by Scott Walker. What he did to education, what he did to the Department of Natural Resources, what he did to teachers' unions, what he did with everything he did, he worked to remove all that money. And that lady you just had on said it perfectly. If we invest in our kids, we invest in the country. If we don't invest in our kids, we don't invest in our country. It's their choice. And millionaires, that's where they think they want to put their money. We need to roll back all the damage that Scott Walker did. That'll make their heads explode, but that's the truth. And if you want to make their heads explode, tell them the truth. Thank you so much.
Hey, you bet, Bill. Have a great day. Appreciate the call. And again, just making the case that what Scott Walker and Republicans did and what the pandemic did, these are all things that can be adjusted in a budget, every time. And that's all that the folks we've had on this hour are talking about, is saying, talk to your hometown legislator and say, hey, before this passes, how about making this adjustment or that adjustment and putting things more in line with Wisconsin priorities? Millionaire tax cuts, not necessarily that way. All right, it's time for three things to know to start the week, and that's where we head over to Civic Media News Director Terry Bell, who I hope had a good weekend. How are you, Terry?
I'm great, and I did have a nice weekend, Pat. How was yours?
It was very nice. I was saying at the top of the show, and I don't have the box in front of me anymore, I was cleaning out the basement, and I cannot believe how many old phones and old iPods and other things that I have, and it's some point I got to figure out what to do with all of this stuff. And I'm wondering if there's like maybe a big metal shredder like you see on TV.
Well, you know, a lot of municipalities will have a free electronics recycling weekend at some point in the year. I know in Dane County, it's usually towards late summer or so. So that's maybe something to look into.
At some point, something's got to be done. We have had so busy a morning that we actually haven't hit on the first of your three things to know about. So it's very appropriate there. We followed something that we thought was going to be such monumental news, and then it turned out to be kind of a blip, but we almost had a coup in Russia over the weekend.
We were very, very, we were on the precipice of a big global event. Things seem to have calmed down now. Yeah, so there is this individual, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who owns his own private army, although it's kind of a it cooperates very much with Russia, operates in 30 countries. Anyway, he was very good friends with Vladimir Putin for a long time, big supporter of the war in Ukraine, big participant in the war in Ukraine. For one reason or another, these two had a falling out within the last few days, and Prigozhin rallied his private army and came within 129 miles of Moscow before apparently the president of Belarus stepped in and brokered an agreement between Putin and Prigozhin. And the whole thing is off now. Prigozhin was trying to, I think his public relations effort was couching this as a march for justice and having something to do with the war in Ukraine. I think that was just his PR. I think it just really boiled down to a beef between these two guys. But it
I think the beef was that too many of his men were getting killed in Ukraine because he was making these videos, Prigozhin was, criticizing the military, Putin's military commanders. And honestly, Terry, they looked like those videos that you see on wrestling shows. You know, you're doing a terrible job and I'm coming to you. And it looked almost like really bad entertainment, but he was actually quite serious. And then there were reports that maybe Putin was trying to have the regular Russian army essentially wipe out Prigozhin's people through a friendly fire incident, and that maybe that's what precipitated Prigozhin to turn around. But look at the question marks. Does Prigozhin stay in Belarus? Does he really just say, oh, you know, bygones be bygones? Does he mysteriously fall out a hotel window, which happens to a lot of, you know, Putin's critics over the years? Does Putin last? I mean, remember, Gorbachev survived a coup attempt, but 4 months later, he went away, and so did the entire Soviet Union. It dissolved. So there's so many things we need to keep watching on this.
We need to keep watching. I mean, I don't know whether it's just, you know, between these two or whether this is actually some part of some sort of populist uprising. I have my suspicions, but we will see how this plays out.
Yeah, really it is. Okay, let's take it back home. And number two thing to watch this week, we've mentioned a few times on the program this morning already, is that we may see what I would call the top of the ninth inning on the state budget.
Certainly. So now the budget is in the hands of the full legislature. It passed the Joint Finance Committee late last week. And we will see now whether who will blink first, the legislative Republicans or Governor Evers. The JFC Joint Finance Committee kept the $32 million cut to the University of Wisconsin system in the budget. The Governor Evers has said is a deal breaker for him. He would veto the entire thing if that $32 million cut stays in. The question is, will it stay in? Will they put the money back, or will they put some of the money back? And would putting some of the money back be enough to, you know, negate a veto? We don't know yet. It's going to be very interesting. I suspect a couple of late nights this week as lawmakers stake their positions and hash it out.
Oh, yeah. There'll be multiple amendments on the floor that will take things well into the wee smalls. But then in particular, you note that we should be watching what happens with something called the Office of School Safety.
Right. So this was created back in 2018, right after the Parkland, Florida school shooting, a new division of the state justice department. The Office of School Safety is probably best known throughout Wisconsin for the school safety hotline, that if people had an inkling that somebody was up to making some trouble in a school, they could call this hotline and the authorities would get on it. That was created with federal money, kept going with COVID relief money, and that money is set to expire at the end of the year, and presumably this office will go away or this effort will go away unless the legislature puts the money back, which so far it does not seem inclined to do.
Again, all about setting priorities, legislators. Terry Bell, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a great day. And remember, you can follow me on Facebook, Pat Kreitlow Up North, all one word. Thank you for every download of the podcast. Those of you listening live, keep it right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Have a great Monday. We'll see you tomorrow.